All right, so let's go to 1 Timothy chapter 5. We've been making our way slowly through this text. We're getting near the end, though. We've been looking at, again, this idea of soundness, soundness in message, members, minister, and now ministry. And in our study a week ago, we were looking at the first part of chapter 5, where Paul is giving instructions in regard to caring for widows. He said that the congregation there in Ephesus and the others, that they should care for their widows. He mentions this idea of those who are truly widows, which, as we've studied, he's identifying those women who are maybe even men who've been left estranged, alone, and in need of help. And so he gave some instructions about that, and also some warnings to the congregation as well as to widows to not allow themselves to be caught up in passions of the flesh or in wickedness, but that they should remain faithful. So we left off last week looking at verse 17, and that's where I want to start this study. So if you'll go with me there, he's going to go back to a different topic that he's already discussed earlier in chapter 3. But let's read it together. He says, "Let elders who rule well be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in preaching and teaching. For the scripture says, you shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain, and the laborer deserves his wages." So we'll deal with that, and then we'll come back to some other things he has to say about elders and the church's response to their eldership. So he says that elders who rule well should be considered of double honor. Now, if my understanding is correct, what I believe that means is, number one, this idea of double honor refers to the idea that you should respect them. You should respect your elders. You should hold them in high regard, and not to make their job overly harsh or difficult, but you should strive to make their job easier, and also to say thank you for the work and the effort they put in. But he adds this idea of ruling well. All elders are, of course, expected to do a good job at what they're doing, to take that task on. But I believe when he's saying rule well here, the ideal is not the condition of their service or the quality of their service, but the quantity of their service. That they are doing more than just supervising or overseeing the flock, but they are actually teaching the flock. And they're taking a very prominent role in preaching and in teaching. And so he goes on in verse 18 to talk about this idea that you shall not muzzle an ox, right? You don't forbid the ox who's working the opportunity to eat. And he backs it up with a second illustration where he says, or statement, the laborer deserves his wages. So in other words, what he's saying is that if you have an elder who is serving both in the position of bishop overseer, but also is doing a majority of preaching, you should pay him. You should care for his needs and offer him that. So, would all elders fall into that? No, but he's talking about those who spend their time and their labor in the proclamation of the word. But is there anything wrong with us paying elders? No, and actually I think it's commanded for the elder who goes beyond the normal call in his preaching and teaching.
Do you know any churches that do that? I've heard it.
Yeah, I do. What were you saying, Lisa?
Oh, I was just saying that I have.
Yeah, I've heard of several congregations. I don't know what I'm trying to add to that, but yes. Now, does it happen frequently? No. But I do know of occasions when that has occurred.
It's usually like a really large congregation.
No, not always. No, not always.
We had one of the people recently who came to one of the spring or fall where he's actually an elder in the congregation as well as a preacher.
Oh, yeah.
So he's doing double duty there, an elder and a preacher.
Yeah, that recalls to my mind. I can't think who it is. But yeah, I do know men who do that. Will be the full-time preacher and an elder at the same time, or even a part-time minister while serving as an elder. Absolutely. Any other questions?
Where do you get that? Like, how do you know that double honor? Money?
Okay, great question. I'm looking at the context, because what follows immediately after is the idea of giving funds or supporting the work of an elder in verse 18, when he gives us those two, that illustration and then the direct statement of a laborer's worth his wages. So to me, that's in the context.
Greek word used in there by the third one I'm using right now, it says team A is a Greek word, it means value, money paid, so concrete or collectively valued. So,
you're talking about the double honor thing?
That's double honor, actually, that word used for honor actually implies money is provided to the person.
That would be my interpretation of that. Now, if you're wanting to study about paying preachers in general, and people have questions about that sometimes, Paul also talks about paying a preacher, 1 Corinthians chapter 9. You can go over there and look at that text as well. But here he's directly applying it to elders who are preaching and teaching. Good questions. All right, let's go into verse 19. He then goes now to talk about, okay, the first part is you should support a man who's doing elders, serving the elder and preaching. And then he says, okay, what about when issues come up? So verse 19, do not admit a charge against an elder except how? On the evidence of two or three witnesses. As for those who persist in sin, rebuke them in the presence of all, so that the rest may stand in fear. He goes now to times when you maybe have someone in the congregation who has something against an elder. And in this context, this isn't just some personal difference. It's not a personality issue or some interpersonal thing, but it has to do with what?
Persistent in sin.
So that's in verse 20. Verse 19, he talks about that before you lay a charge at an elder's feet, what should be required?
Only evidence for two or three.
And that's, in the Old Covenant, Deuteronomy 19:15, Moses talks about that within the law of Moses and how you are to lay charges against another Israelite. Well, here, it's the same kind of principle that Paul is talking about. So when he says two or three witnesses, what's the idea here? Or even just a misunderstanding, right?
It
should be well-founded. Now, when he says to lay a charge, who are we laying a charge before? Do not admit a charge.
Congregation.
Yeah, I would say this is the point when you're going before the congregation. I go back to, Jesus in Matthew's gospel when he says that when we have a fault between us and a brother, how do we handle that? Well, we first go to them. And so Paul is saying, have you done that, I think. I think that's the implied idea here. Have you went to them personally? Then Jesus says, what's the next step? Go to the congregation?
Take two or three.
No, then you go back with two or three people. Why do you go with two or three? You're establishing the issue. And that's what Jesus says, so that the issue may be established. I think that's what Paul's saying. Two or three witnesses. You're establishing that what's going on here is really what you think it is, or what you're saying it is. And so all of that work should have been done before you ever go to the congregation and say, I've got fault against this elder for this reason. We have to be very careful about accusation against elders. Now, we got to be careful against anybody in the congregation, in particular in this context, it's against elders. Now, what happens if there is evidence and it is well-founded? Well, verse 20, you go to that elder, you've been yourself, then you go back with two or three witnesses, it's well-established, and he persists in sin. What should happen? According to what Paul has to say. What? The congregation and the eldership itself needs to rebuke him publicly. And why in particular would he affirm this with elders? They're the leadership, right? And if you let things go by the leadership, if you've got an elder who's persisting in sin. Now remember, this is sin. This isn't your personal difference, opinions, right? You better make sure it's sin. And that's why you do all the work ahead of time to establish the issue. Because maybe you got it wrong. But if you establish there's sin going on and you have an elder who persists in that sin, well then, you need to rebuke him before the congregation. You're practicing discipline with this brother, and if he continues in it, of course he can't remain as an elder, but more than that, he has to be disciplined by the congregation, just like you would any other member. So you're very careful about ever doing this, but if it ever gets to that point, it needs to be dealt with, and dealt with not privately, behind closed doors, but publicly, or not publicly, but with the congregation. Yes.
What you allow becomes acceptable error.
Yes.
Let it go now.
And not just acceptable, but it's been endorsed. The whole lump. Yeah, that's exactly true. And so, so he deals here with how to deal with an elder who is persistent in sin. He's going to go on to talk a little bit more about this. Verse 21, in the presence of God and of Christ Jesus and of the elect angels. He's talking about, this is the command. Hold on a second. This is Paul talking to Timothy. This is his charge to Timothy. All the things we've talked about, Timothy, I charge you in the presence of God, of Christ, and of elect angels, I charge you to keep these rules without what? Prejudging, doing nothing from partiality. Again, going back to this idea, be careful with how you condemn people. You can't allow prejudice of any sort to get in the way. You can't let things slide because you like that guy, but man, I'm not as friendly with him, so I'm going to be harder on him. You can't do that. You have to be careful about doing those things. So he says, lay these things, keep, and notice what he says, keep these what? Keep these rules, right? This isn't Paul's opinions. These are the rules. So when he's talking about honoring widows, in a second, he's going to talk about bondservants. Earlier, he's talked about, public reading. He's talking about those who preach false doctrines. All these things, Paul says, you charge these rules without any prejudgment or partiality, but you keep them. Verse 22, he says, "Do not be hasty in laying on of hands, nor take part in the sins of others. Keep yourself pure." There's a lot just in that verse. I won't spend a whole lot of time. But he says, "Do not be hasty in laying of hands." Exactly what is Paul talking about? Probably in the use of his spiritual gifts. Is one, at least it's one possibility of what he means here. So whatever gifts Timothy had, he should not be what?
Hasty
in doing those things. Those need to be well thought out. Be careful with how you're using those gifts. And then he kind of makes a little bit of a transition while he shouldn't be hasty in using those gifts, he also needs to be what? Careful not to
commit sin.
Not to commit sin, but to get, yes, but to get caught up in the sins of others. I always think about Galatians 6. It's the first one that comes to my mind. But in Galatians 6, what does Paul say to the Galatians? He says, if any one of you is overtaken in any trespass, what's the next words? Galatians 6, 1, 2, following there. Let the spiritually minded go to that person. But go over there for just a minute. I want you to notice what he says. Galatians 6. He says, Galatians 6 and verse 1. If anyone... Brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, any sin, you who are spiritual, some translations have the word spiritual minded, should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. And then notice the little tagline afterwards. Doing what? Keep watch on yourself, lest you too be tempted. All right, so if we're going to bear one another's burdens, to help one another, to be spiritually minded, that part of that implies the idea that I need to be watchful over me, so that I don't become the hypocrite. So he says, keep yourself pure. And that's hard work. But that's what's expected, especially in Timothy's position. He's a preacher, and Ronnie's getting up there Sunday and throughout the week and telling these people they need to live right, you need to live upright, you need to serve God. Was Timothy doing that? There's some onus on him, right? You got to keep yourself pure so that you don't play the hypocrite. And when you make a mistake, you need to repent. Any questions about that before we transition to 23? Yeah. And, people watch us. And they know when we're hypocritical. And we ought to just be honest sometimes with people. I'm not perfect. I got a lot of work to do. So don't consider I've arrived perfection. I'm trying. But at the same time, we need to try to live as pure a life as we can. So verse 23 is an interesting text. I'm going to spend just a minute on it. I won't spend forever. But it seems as though Timothy had some kind of physical ailment. Notice what he says. No longer drink only water, but use a little wine for the sake of your stomach and for your frequent ailments. So he turns his attention here to Timothy's physical health. And Paul instructs him to drink a little wine. Now that term is the word oikonos, or oikonos, how you want to pronounce it. And when we hear the term wine, I don't know if you're like me, but I think most people, you think automatically of alcoholic wine. That might be what's going on here, but it doesn't necessarily imply that. That word is a very broad term and has a big spectrum to it. It can mean alcoholic wine, fermented wine, or it could simply mean grape juice, or somewhere a little bit in between. It's hard, honestly, to define. So I just want to note that. Sometimes we just take things for granted that that's what it means, and it may not mean that. I don't know. But it is interesting in this text that Paul qualifies it, doesn't he?
A little.
He says a little, right? Number one, you notice that he doesn't say, whatever it is, don't drink to full consumption. Drink a little, right? The other thing that stands out to me about this, no matter whatever is meant here by wine, is it seems as though Timothy didn't want to do it. He's having to be told to do it, right? And so he seems to be very apprehensive about it. And Paul is saying, you're using this for medicinal use. Use it for that purpose. And so I strive to try to understand how people can use this to support social drinking. It defies me, but people will. If you want something, you're going to look for it and try to find it. I do not know how you can use this text to support social drinking of alcohol. This is medicinal. It's Paul urging him to do it. It's the use of little. He's proportionate here, small proportion. And also, we're making a big assumption by saying it's alcoholic. It might be, but we don't know. Yes, Doug?
My wife, studying on it, the word is typically used of alcohol and wine. Most of it uses across Greek and stuff like that, but it may help understand that apparently in the times, they didn't give straight wine. Wine was usually mixed 1 to 3 parts at least. 1 part wine, 2 parts water, or maybe 3 parts water. Mm-hmm. So you didn't get straight wine when people were giving you wine. It was done because their society, just like across scriptures, being inebriated was not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
That was not it. So that's the whole idea behind it. They watered it down basically to minimize the alcohol content, to minimize the chance that someone's going to get inebriated by drinking the stuff. So the whole idea behind it is not to seek to go crazy and not be able to think and act right and all that stuff if you drank so much stuff. You were supposed to take pain, if you will, to not get buzzed.
Hmm. Absolutely. I think that's a good point. It's not to get buzzed. He wasn't telling Timothy to get buzzed or to feel comfortable in a crowd. He's, you're sick. You need help. To me, it's no different than a doctor assigning a drug to help you feel better, to help with the physical element of what I'm trying to say. So I want to deal with that real quick, and then we'll move on. Let's go to verse 24. So now he comes back to talk about sin. And so he says in verse 24, the sins of some people are conspicuous. Pretty obvious, right? It's the ideal there. They're well known. Going before them to judgment. But the sins of others appear later. Isn't that interesting? Some people are not very good at hiding their sin. They're just out there, out front with it. They don't care. However, others of us get very good at hiding it. Get very good at cloaking it. That's a scary verse for us as Christians, by the way. Get to judgment only to be found out. Christians ever try to hide their sin? When I'm using that in scare quotes, Christian, right? He's, and again, he's talking to the church. He says some people's sins are obvious. They're conspicuous. However, others, they hide it well. And then he kind of throws that on its head a little, or he talks about the reverse of that, and he says, so also good works are conspicuous. And even those cannot remain hidden. What do you think he means by that? How is he making this comparison? What's he trying to say to Timothy and to us? Okay, I think that's good. And then also, who else is going to find out? God's going to know. God knows. You're not hiding your good works from Him. He's not ignorant of your good deeds. He takes note of those things. And those things will be found out as well on Judgment Day. Enter in, my good and faithful servant. Right? And so Paul is reminding Timothy, yeah, the world may not like what you're doing. The world may be against you at times. Even the church itself may be hard, may treat you harshly. But God takes note. And God knows what you're doing. So remain faithful. Continue on. And then we go to chapter 6 and verse 1. He says, let all who are under a yoke of bondservants regard their own masters as worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and the teaching may not be reviled. Those who have believing masters must not be disrespectful on the grounds they are brothers. Rather, they must serve all the better, since those who benefit by their good service are believers and beloved. So, interesting here. When he uses the word bondservant, he's talking about slaves. But we need to identify what he means by slavery here. When we look historically, there's not all one kind of slavery or bondservant. We're well aware that there have been times in our past, in other countries' past, many others, where you've had men and women kidnapped from their homes and brought to other places to work and to serve someone else. And you have this kind of kidnapping slavery. That's one type, and it has occurred. There's another type of slavery that's very different. Which is the thought or the idea that someone incurs a debt that they're unable to pay, and rather than to go to prison and to serve their debt that way, they choose to establish a relationship where they work toward their freedom. Or not freedom, sorry, not the rest of the word, but they to work to pay off the debt that they owed. What's under consideration here? Paul does not define it for us. So we're left a little bit to wonder about when he's using that term, what does he mean by it? But in the first century, you had slaves and you had masters. We're going to look at the letter to Philemon in a little bit, in a few weeks, I hope. Where you have there another slave and master situation. So, number one, is Paul here endorsing kidnapping slavery? No, I don't think he is. I just think he's dealing with a reality. It goes on. And so, living in that situation, how should a Christian react? What should our reaction, if we were in that situation, how should we handle it? So what is he telling us? What should be the the reaction of someone who finds himself in that kind of condition. Yeah, and that's a really fascinating relationship, isn't it? We're like in Philemon Onesimus in that letter, where you have two brothers. They're both Christians. Philemon, we're not sure who converted him. Onesimus seems to have been converted by Paul. And that's going to make a fascinating condition, isn't it? Now, just imagine this for a minute. Imagine a situation where you have two Christians, where the bondservant is an elder, and the master is a member of the congregation. Wow, that's a duality of relationship. How do you deal with that? Well, Paul is trying to give some instruction toward that when he says that, number one, they ought to honor their master. And then in verse 2, he says, if those who have believing masters must not be what?
Disrespectful
on the grounds that they are brothers. So he says, you can't use the relationship you have in Christ in order to try to use that as some benefit for you. But as Doug said, you need to think about, how can I honor God even in this situation? So, again, a difficult situation, no doubt about it. But what does God not call us to? Rebellion. And that's a hard pill to swallow sometimes. But why would God not call to rebellion in those situations? Nobody wants to answer that one, do they? Opportune for witness.
It's hard to maintain some of the other characteristics of people who are Christian. When you're fighting people all the time, probably speaking things you shouldn't speak, that kind of behavior. So dealing with it, if you will, under a Christian mannerism and doing what you can and then just working with the people through it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they wanted to be, because they didn't have any money, and so their masters are really taking care of them, and they're working to pay off the debt. So that would really not be right to rebel against that.
Yes, and that's a good point. So you have to ask the question, you know, what kind of bond servant are we dealing with? If it's a condition you've got yourself into, right, where you're working off a debt you owe, it would really not be right for you just to say, hey, I'm not going to pay this debt anymore. I'm going to run away. I'm going to rebel against this. In the other situation, where you're in a situation where you've been taken as a slave, it's different. But the example I think about, and it's always easier to talk about things when you're not in it, right? So we can all step back and look at this from a 30,000 foot view. But I'm just trying to deal with what God says. I think about Joseph. Think about Joseph's life. He ended up in slavery. He did not deserve it. He was sold into slavery. Yet, he didn't rebel, did he? But what did he do? And he continued. Yes. And he continued to be faithful. We're studying the book of Daniel, right, on our Thursday class. Daniel was a slave, and he was taken in war. He was not a bondservant in the sense that he was working off a debt, yet he didn't rebel, but he remained faithful to God. We have no idea in our lives what God's doing. In the story of Joseph, we know God was doing something. Now, what if Joseph had been a rebellious person and said, you know, I don't deserve to be here. And he didn't deserve to be there. It wasn't right. But it's just like our parents told us a long time ago, isn't it? Life's not fair. But all we can do is the best with what we, where we are, whatever that condition is. And so that's a hard thing somewhat to hear, but God is asking Onesimus, he's asking Daniel, and he's asking Joseph and others to say, hey, continue to look to me, because what you're going to have afterwards will far surpass the difficulty you're going through now. So, is it fair in some of those situations? Absolutely not.
But them crucifying Jesus wasn't fair.
Amen.
He set an example for us.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me of the little girl in the old covenant. What's his name? That went to get down in the water, second time.
You're talking about Naaman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She was captured, and she actually told her master, her headway.
And he became a believer in God because of it.
That's what I'm trying to get
at. Yeah, no, you're right. Now, one other element to this, I just want to mention, and we'll be done with class, but the other kind of element here is, what if we live in a cultural system where that kind of slavery is practiced? There's nothing to say that we can't say that's wrong, right? To man steal and kidnap and to force somebody into slavery. But what we cannot do is what?
Rebel.
Rebel in the sense of we're violently or illegally trying to do things to overthrow. That's not who we are. Now, I can speak against slavery and the ills of it and the sinful nature of it. I mean, God says, kidnapping is wrong. Man-stealing is wrong. He condemns that. But as a Christian, if that's going on in my culture, in the world around me, I can definitely speak out against it. But I don't do it in a rebellious way where I'm doing the evil that I'm condemning or some other evil. And I'm condemning this evil over here. The two wrongs don't justify it. And it may be that I live my whole life in that condition, but do I live faithfully? Daniel lived his whole life from the time he was kidnapped to the time he died in captivity. He was never freed. He died in captivity. Yet what did he do with his life? He served God. And so whatever condition I find myself in, I should serve God. Good comment. So, any others with that before I close? All right, the next section here, as we get near the end of class, he gives a third warning toward false teachers. So next week, we'll come back, we'll pick up there with verse 2 and into 3. And we'll go through the end of 1 Timothy. But we'll look at false teaching and it's the dangers of it. And also in this, he's going to talk about the love of money. And this is where we find that very popular verse in verse 10, where he talks about the root of the love of money. Sorry, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And he'll come back and discuss the temptations surrounding wealth and being rich and the pursuit of being wealthy. Thank you all. We'll dismiss now and rejoin for our devotional in a few minutes. Thank you.